Greetings, one and all. Today, I have special guest Jerry McMullen with me from the Worst Comic Podcast Ever, and we talk about Star Wars today on Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. Hello, and welcome to the show. I am your host, Randy Andrews, and I have special guest Jerry McMullen from the Worst Comic Podcast Ever with me today. Hello, Jerry. It's nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for inviting me. I have been a big fan of your show ever since episode one. I love your format. I love getting the insights into the soundtracks. I mean, there's a lot. So much of the time, you hear the soundtracks, but you don't always pay that close of attention. I think you're more focused on watching the movie, and you don't really realize how important the soundtracks are to a movie until you pull back and listen to the music separately, and maybe go back and watch a movie again a second time, which your podcast has encouraged me to go do.
Yeah, I have found that as I've went through, it's made me more aware of the soundtrack, even of films that I'm not really used to appreciating. Mm-hmm. Like the second episode, Lawrence of Arabia, it's such a long movie.
Yeah.
It's 4 hours long, and it's hard to think about just the film itself, but then when you add the music, you find it has just a whole nother beautiful layer of sound that you never thought that it was there. So
yeah, and that was actually a movie that had they actually used to have intermissions in movies for those longer ones because of having to change the reels out in the projection rooms. And so that's definitely a movie you need to take a little 10-15 minute break during the middle of, just in order to make it all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. So Star Wars, A New Hope, is one of my favorite movies. It's on my top 10 list for top 10 movies of all time.
I would have it in my mind as well. I was actually thinking about it this morning. I think this is probably the movie I have watched the most times.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you.
And I've probably owned it the most times in so many different formats. I think the first time I got it, I actually taped it off of HBO in the early 80s. I went through at least three different VHS sets. I've got it on Blu-ray now. Mm-hmm. So Lucas keeps finding a way to resell us the same thing over and over. And you know what? I keep buying the same thing over and over.
Yeah. It's just a influential movie, personal experience. My mom would have to say that Star Wars kind of influenced my love of science fiction because they took me to Star Wars when I was a baby.
Okay.
And they went to see it at the Indian Hills Theater here in Omaha. And that movie theater was a very specific type of theater. It had what you would call a CinemaScope screen. Mm-hmm. It was very unusual. They only made so many projection films for that screen specifically.
Sure.
Because it was so long.
Yeah.
The screen was so long and they couldn't just do a normal movie on it.
Yeah. Offhand, do you remember where Indian Hills was?
It was right off of 90th, like between 85th and 90th of Dodge Street in Omaha.
Okay.
And now there's just a Methodist hospital office building there. And
I grew up in Omaha and
oh,
I'm
okay.
familiar with that area. And I live just a little bit to the south of that area. I remember going to see Star Wars. There was a theater off of 84th and Center. And that's where I saw all the big movies growing up. I saw Star Wars, I saw Empire, I saw Raiders, E.T., I mean, all of those big ones from the 70s and 80s. That's the theater that we went to go see them. So I actually remember my dad, God bless him, he had to sit through a lot of movies with me, but we were actually waiting to see Star Trek the Motion Picture, and our movie got. Of course, back then they really didn't have a lobby area. You actually had to wait outside and wait, lines formed around the building, waiting to get in. And Star Trek, the motion picture opened in December, and a car had hit a power pole or something, and the theater lost power. And so we were stuck outside for like an extra hour before we could get in to see our showing. But yeah, I love that theater, and it's funny how you have those memories of that childhood theater like that, and they stick with you all the way through.
Yeah, it really does. That theater just was an amazing theater. It had a really amazing sound quality. It had, like, in 1996, I went to see Twister.
Yes.
And you could hear the debris behind you. And there were no speakers behind you in that theater. The acoustics were so good that you could hear the debris behind you and the wind and the sounds behind you. And even when Star Wars came out for the special edition, I went to see it there at Indian Hills. And I mean, it just was an amazing experience. And Star Wars is just one of those pieces of history that will never go away. And I have found that in my research for just looking at the different actors and how they reacted to the new movie of what it was and how it was to be filmed. Like when we think about C-3PO and Anthony Daniels, he had no interest in the movie. And he only agreed to meet George Lucas just to be polite. And almost immediately, Anthony Daniels, he was intrigued by Ralph McQuarrie's art for
Yes,
C-3PO.
the concept art that he did for everything, and he really did that for like all the movies
Exactly.
before they went into production.
According to the notes that I have, that he said that he believed it was the major reason why he selected, or he was selected, to be C-3PO, and why some other people just didn't meet the standard. And it changed his opinion of this new type of way of filming and new genre that he hadn't ever experienced before. And it just really was an interesting way of looking at just even Anthony Daniels.
Absolutely. When the movies came out, it was obviously well before the internet. And so those McQuarrie prints were some of the earliest teases of what was coming up in a movie. I mean, you had no idea what was going to be coming up. There was no spoilers going on at that time. I mean, I remember for Empire, there was a scene where like you saw Vader and Luke battling, but Luke was wearing like some kind of like oxygen mask or tank. And my mind was just blown away thinking, all right, how do you fight a battle like that? And just trying to imagine the possibilities.
Ralph McQuarrie kind of fueled the imagination for Star Wars. It was astounding, really. I found that some of the actors, such as Carrie Fisher or Mark Hamill, or even David Prowse and even Harrison Ford. I have four different like types of notes on, for instance, Harrison Ford. He didn't learn his lines for the intercom conversation when they were in the cell block.
Yes.
He just did it and made it sound so spontaneous. And my wife and I, we were reenacting that together because we were laughing about it because it was so influential, because he made it sound so conversational and yet so perfect for the
Yeah.
scene. We're all fine here now. How are you? So, that was just like one of the facts. I didn't even realize that he just kind of ad-libbed with that.
Yeah, that was kind of his style or his method, especially back then, was just kind of wean it and make it sound a little more natural.
Yeah, exactly. Another actor, well, David Prowse, who was in the Darth Vader suit.
Yeah, the Bobby.
He was kind of disgruntled more than 20 years after the film was released because his voice was replaced by James Earl Jones. And I guess in a interview, he had claimed that he was a victim of reverse racism because the cast had no black members, and the studio was worried they would lose a significant slice of the audience. However, James Earl Jones, he wasn't even credited in the original film. So no one even knew that there was a black actor voicing Darth Vader.
David Prowse has a very high-pitched voice.
Okay.
And if you listen to any of the old original filming where he was doing the dialogue, it sounds so freakish. I mean, it doesn't sound right. You need a deep-sounding voice. And I know David Prowse is probably upset for just having walked around in the movies for all these years, but I also think he collected a lot of money from those
Oh,
movies, so he can't complain too much if his voice wasn't in there. But the simple fact that so much of Darth Vader is built around that voice, James Earl Jones, and I don't think the movie would nearly been as successful. It would still have done bonkers, but the a high-pitched Darth Vader would not have flown as this force of evil
No.
that's out to control the galaxy.
Not at all. It just, it was one of those pieces of information that I was like, wow, I didn't realize that he felt so strongly about, not being voiced in the film. It's like, well, think about it. One of the unique things I found was, how there are stunt doubles for many films, and one scene that they didn't use stunt doubles for was when Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher swung across that
The chasm.
the chasm. They swung across and they performed the stunt themselves, did it all in one take. And I was like, wow. I mean, they took a risk there, but of course they weren't very high off the ground, but
No.
it made it appear that way.
Sure.
So, one of the other facts I found, it was really interesting that the Banthas in the movie, they were actually Asian elephants dressed in a costume of fur and even fake horns, and they even taught the elephants to put their trunk into their mouth so it wouldn't hang down. And
Interesting.
some of them, they had to be removed from the set several times because of the extreme heat of where those scenes were filmed in Death Valley.
Well, were those in Death Valley or Tunisia? Because
No,
a lot of.
those were actually done in Death Valley.
Okay. Because I know, like, the Lars homestead and all, that's actually over in Tunisia. and there was actually just a project a couple of years ago to save or reclaim that set, because it had pretty much been abandoned and was just falling apart due to the weather. And this crew went in and basically rebuilt it up and made it back into like a, almost like a tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There have been so many unique facts about the film. You know, you think about all the things you hear about, you know, for Star Wars, and you get into like the scene with the stormtroopers coming into that control room, and the one stormtrooper hits his head on the door. And that's like one of those common retrospective facts that they just decided to leave it in the film. I found that most, even with the stormtroopers themselves, most of them were left-handed because of the weapons that were constructed.
Okay.
And the weapons were actually based upon a real weapon where the magazine was on the left side of the weapon. So the construction caused it to hit the stormtrooper's chest. And so they had to switch the grip of the weapon and made them all look left-handed.
Yeah.
And I found that really interesting. And also, you know, the whole controversy with the shootout between Han Solo and Greedo in the cantina. How many debated that Greedo shot first before Solo, and vice versa. And of course we know Han shot first. It doesn't matter how much they digitally change it, Han still shot first. And we can really appreciate that.
That's why I keep one of my sets of VHS tapes still.
Yeah. Because it just proves that, yep, Han Solo shot first. And then, you know, going back to Ralph McQuarrie, I mean, his conceptual art was so influential that you think about the Darth Vader design. I mean, that's how they came up with Darth Vader's suit. It was designed by Ralph McQuarrie, who was even concerned about the character being able to breathe while he was traveling in his spaceship.
Yeah.
It's
interesting, if you talk to like comic book artists and such, the Darth Vader costume is very hard to draw.
Yeah, I would imagine.
You really need to have, you know, the like reference in front of you when you're drawing it, or else it just looks horrendous. I mean, there's very few artists that I know of that can draw it, you know, off of memory and have it come out looking accurate.
Yeah, the even I myself, I have drawn my own Darth Vader, and it just doesn't look right. I even had a reference, and it just doesn't look right. So, but the look of the suit was based upon robes worn by the Bedouin warriors. I like the fact that George Lucas had ILM watch archival footage of the World War II dogfights to have the references for the Death Star scene.
Yeah. Well, Lucas is an old school film fanatic. And he went through the film school out in LA, and the whole concept of Star Wars is a homage to the 1940s and 50s serials, whether they be westerns or war movies. I mean, it was kind of like telling these little story arcs and building to a climactic point, and then coming back down, then building up to the next climactic point. So it very much feels like a serial where you could break that movie up into like six or seven pieces and go once a week to watch something and be hooked on it and want to come back again the next week to see what's going to happen.
I found it really unique that, you know, they use that to give frames of reference, so that way things would look kind of more authentic in a way to be a science fiction film, but still have some relation to the modern world. It just was astounding to me, you know, the different ways they made the footage, like doing the Dystroflex motion controlled camera, and how when they would program that, they could program it to actually film on a matte painting. So that way it would look even more than just a painting, but more like that you're filming a scene of a background or whatever, and then you have your actors come in and play their parts.
You know, you started this conversation talking about how influential Star Wars is as a film, and this is one of those areas. I mean, because prior to that, special effects were like horrendous. If you go back and watch movies prior to Star Wars, I mean, maybe the most special effect type movie might have been like 2001, A Space Odyssey. But money just wasn't put into special effects to make it look realistic. They would find ways to change the story around or tell the story without actually having to show those type of scenes or include that within the movie. And so much of Star Wars was just literally, how can we make this work? And let's get creative and find ways to do it. You know, the Death Star models that they built, they basically scavenged around with little model kits of battleships and planes and all that, and used parts from one set and another to build up the Death Star and the other ships. You know, the Death Star trench was actually a full-scale model built in the London studio, so they could actually roll a camera down to get the view of it as you're flying along and inside the view from like Luke's X-wing. It was just, I mean, they were creatively going out and hitting things and recording the sounds just to kind of get different sounds to use within the movie. I want to say like the blaster fire is the sound of like hitting a pipe against a tension support cable on a bridge. I mean, it's things like that that you would never think of, but recording that sound and then looping it into the film gives it a whole new layer.
I found that, you know, with George Lucas, he used so many influences from other things, like other films. Like you had talked about the old 1950s serials and things like that, such as Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers, Frank Herbert's Dune, J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the Kurosawa films, The Hidden Fortress. Of that film, it was like dealing with a famous warrior and a princess who needed to be moved safely to allied territory from being pursued by hostiles. And it kind of served as the inspiration for the whole main story of A New Hope. And just, you know, seeing that George Lucas had the Admiral refer in the film to this rebel base as their hidden fortress rather than a, you know, hidden base to kind of give it more of a archaic flair, and just the different scenes that were used, the Mayan temple that was used for the base on Yavin 4. That was really amazing. I mean, just the different film locations that George Lucas used with Tunisia and getting that just perfect sunrise or sunset, whichever one it was, to where you had the optical illusion of two suns.
Yeah, that two sun image is very striking. I know my podcast partner Colin still gets all crazy over that image, and just he grins like a little 5-year-old kid seeing that shot again for the first time every time he watches it. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. Also, you know, it's really impressive how they were really setting the standard for even building sets, building equipment, building machines, such as the Millennium Falcon. According to, I think, one of the builders for one of the sets, Roger Christian, I think it was, he said that it was the Millennium Falcon was the most difficult item to build. He wanted the interior to look kind of like a submarine, and he found scrap airplane metal that no one wanted to use those days and bought it. Like, he bought those pieces, and then he began his creation process by breaking down these jet engines into scrap pieces, giving him the chance to stick it in the set in a specific way. And I guess it took him several weeks to finish the chess set, which he described as the most encrusted set in the hold of the Falcon. So you can see they spent a lot of time developing these models, these sets, these massively large areas to be used not only once, but several times, because they brought back the Millennium Falcon and brought you clear up to now with The Force Awakens, giving us the interior of the Falcon and knowing that's the same model, that's the same set that they used from the original.
Yeah, it was most of that, most of like the Death Star scenes, the Falcon, all that. Those were set up on, I believe, a sound studio over in London. That so much of the movie was filmed there. And if you look at the cast, almost all the Imperials were of British descent. So they all had that English accent to them as they were speaking. And you even got some of that with Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan Kenobi, but as we've later learned, getting the full backstory over the years to find his ties to everything. But it was very much, you know, the rebels were cast almost as Americans, and the Empire, the people from Great Britain were cast as the Empire, just so that there was a definitive difference in their speaking.
Yeah, as even with Grand Moff Tarkin, Peter Cushing, he was actually liked. I mean, Carrie Fisher said that he was one of the most endearing, charming, polite, and humorous people on the set, and they got along so well that she had an even really hard time doing her scenes as if she hated him, because he was so likable and so easy to work with. And it cracked me up, you know? It was really
You'll
interesting.
notice that the scenes with Grand Moff Tarkin, most of them are filmed from the waist up. He complained about the boots of the uniform hurting his feet. And so most of the times that they were filming him, he was actually in his slippers.
Yeah. That's just hilarious, 'cause it's like they wouldn't need to see his feet all the time. So, when I thought about bringing you on, I was thinking about your ties to comics, your connections to the comic industry. What have you found to be really helpful in thinking about the movie, but then how does it transition when you look at the history of the Star Wars comic?
You know, the Star Wars comic is holds a very unique place in history. First of all, you got to tell part of the backstory. You know, Lucas had been shopping Star Wars around for years before he finally got a studio to agree to help release the film and all of that. The studios basically gave him all of the merchandise rights. They didn't want them. They didn't think that there was any merchandise to be had with this movie. So he controlled everything. And one of the things that he opted was let's create a comic book. And he shopped the idea of the comic around to bunch of the different publishers, and finally Marvel, specifically Roy Thomas, was really intrigued by this story and thought it could be used as a comic, and they signed a deal with Lucasfilm in 1976 and started working off early drafts to create a comic to go along with the movie. And initially, it was just going to be a six-issue comic book series adapting the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the comics sold like crazy. I mean, Marvel was in... That was a period of time where Marvel and the industry was struggling some, but Marvel was in dire shapes. And they talk how the Star Wars comic book saved Marvel in the late 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
That they were selling so many Star Wars comics compared to any of their other books at that time. And so if you look at original copies of those comics, every extra page that wasn't comic related quickly got put in, made into like a house ad for another book. Because
mm-hmm.
they knew that they were getting readers on that comic that weren't reading any other comics, and they want to get other people reading. Now, part of the reason why they had so many people reading these comics, there was nothing else out there for Star Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a couple of paperback novels that came out, like Splinter of the Mind's Eye and
yep.
Han Solo at Star's End, that just kind of, I mean, it was like blood in the water to sharks. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you saw something with Star Wars, you were buying it, because there was nothing else to go along to support it. So people were buying the comic telling the Star Wars story. But Marvel had their hands tied by Lucasfilm with all of this. You know, when Marvel said, went to Lucasfilm and said, hey, we'd kind of like to keep telling stories and keep this comic series going, they're like, okay, that's fine, but you can't have Luke battle Darth Vader, you can't have them meet up with Darth Vader, you can't tell this story, this story, this story, you can't go to this type place or this type place, because they were trying to protect their movies
yeah.
coming out.
Yeah.
So Marvel really kind of had to tell their stories blind. So, you know, the first major story arc...
Well, except for a few facts of knowing where yeah. they couldn't go to.
Yeah, yeah. But really, you know, like the first major story arc after the initial adaption of it was almost like a retelling of the Star Wars, where
yeah.
Han Solo and this group of ragged rebels fight off a local government on this backwater planet, and there's a little kid that looks a lot like Luke Skywalker, and a lady that kind of reminds Han of Princess Leia, and it was just funny. And it wasn't until later on that, you know, Marvel started kind of trying to, all right, let's look at the Imperials, and let's expand on that, and let's go back and tell a story about Obi-Wan Kenobi, and
mm-hmm.
you know, things like that. So that period between Star Wars and Empire, some of those stories are a little rough,
yeah.
but by the same token, that was the only Star Wars stories you were getting on a monthly basis, so
exactly,
people were eating them up. You know, when Empire came out, again, you had more direction,
yep.
but you couldn't tell current stories involving Han Solo.
Nope.
And you couldn't actually have them rescue Han Solo, because you knew that that was going to be saved for Return of the Jedi. So
yeah.
how do you tell stories for 3 years without using Han Solo? Well, we can use them in flashback type stories, and we can tell these type of stories. They even had a two-part story that was an unused John Carter Warlord of Mars story, but adapted for Star Wars. Using Princess Leia and the Empire and such.
Now that I didn't
really,
know.
Some really good stories told in this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be fair, there's some clunkers, but considering that all these stories were done with, you know, their hands tied as to what they could or couldn't do, I think Marvel did a great job. The thing that hurt Marvel is that once Return of the Jedi came out, they had no direction from Lucasfilm,
mm-hmm.
because Lucasfilm really didn't know what they were going to do. And they basically just said, well, tell some stories, but you can't use Darth Vader anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the book drifted around for a couple of years after Return of the Jedi before being canceled in 86. 2 years ago at Omaha Comic Con, Cynthia Martin was there, who was got her start working on the Star Wars comic in that period, and she was so much fun to talk to. She's a local up there in the Omaha area, and if ever you get a chance to meet her, you should check her out.
Oh,
So.
okay. I'll have to do that. I found that, with Dark Horse taking over the reins of Star Wars, and after they were able to have clear, creative license to kind of go their own direction and go in the way of how the books were going, like the book industry just flooded the market with Star Wars books, and it had its entire timeline. It had the Old Republic, it had the New Republic, it had stories that you never thought possible, and it was its own expanded universe of Star Wars. And then when they finally, let's see, in 2013, they anthologized the original 1973 draft of the Star Wars, where you have a different storyline in a way, because Luke is an old general and his pupil is a young Star Killer, and it was adapted into a comic book by Jonathan Renslor, Mike Mayhew, and Nick Runge, and that just, exploded a whole different type of story, and they didn't know really how they were going to use the name Starkiller until, of course, they used it in The Force Awakens. And so it was a really interesting, well-written, and well-drawn book that Dark Horse had done, and this was before Disney bought Marvel.
It
And
was it came out right around that same time that Disney had made the acquisition, and it was based off of Lucas's original screenplay for the movie.
8 issues, and it had even a sketchbook that you could buy separately as its individual comic. And it just was astounding that it was totally different from what the movies developed into.
All stories go along a path much like the movies do themselves, and I enjoyed reading the Star Wars, but I'm glad the story changed around to be what we eventually got in 1977.
Yeah, exactly. And, bringing it back to how that movie really is, and like different comical things that would happen. The scene with the trash compactor, and how there's Mark Hamill being Luke Skywalker, he was so intense in filming the scene that he got pulled under, of course, by that creature that was in the trash compactor. He burst a blood vessel in his eye. And so after that, the next scene that was filmed, I guess, of course, they don't do all the scenes chronologically, but the next scene was where he was filmed as receiving the medals. They were receiving their medals for winning against the Empire, and Mark Hamill, he had to do a lot of grinning in order to keep that big red spot on his eye from being noticeable. And I found that really funny and interesting, because it's like you would have never thought that, these actors would have developed certain things that happened, and it's like, oh, I never noticed that before. And then the whole thing with Carrie Fisher, she wasn't able to wear a bra underneath her costume during filming. George Lucas had ordered her breast held down with gaffer's tape, and Carrie Fisher was informed that there was no underwear in space, but it was more likely an explanation that was Lucas wanted the movie to be good, clean fun without the jiggle action popular, especially on TV during the liberated 70s. And so he, of course, tried to make amends by attempting to desexualize Carrie Fisher's figure by having her wear the metal bikini in Return of the Jedi. But one of the things, I'm sorry, one of the things I was thinking about in regard to her original outfit, she thought that her outfit that she had to wear in Star Wars wasn't revealing enough. I thought it was really funny because when she saw the original posters done by the brothers Hildebrandt, she was shown as her outfit being curvy and voluptuous and seductive and much like those posters. And she thought that that was how her character was going to be portrayed, but she
The
was
dress
rather.
had a slit up to the waist so that the leg could be revealed, and it's definitely interesting. I've seen numerous interviews with Lucas, and he has thought so long and hard about every single detail of the story. I mean, if you ask him why a certain machine sounds like it does, I mean, he'll go into the mechanics of that vehicle to explain why it makes those noises, or the back history of an alien race or a particular character. I mean, he's got everything worked out in his head. Lucas was definitely the creative mind behind. I mean, the simple fact that he gave over director control for Empire and Return of the Jedi speaks so much. And both of those movies were, I think, were better served having other directors in place. But I think for the initial A New Hope, I mean, that is very much a simple story, good versus evil. Good guys wear black or dark colors. The good guys wear white. The Han Solo, we don't know if he's good or bad. He wears both. He was definitely trying to tell a simple good versus evil type story.
He had everything planned out from day one. It was just really unique. I'd like to talk about a few actual soundtrack points.
Absolutely. That's the whole point why we're here.
Exactly.
Let's talk the music. I mean, we haven't even mentioned John Williams yet, who.
John Williams is the reason Star Wars is so popular, and actually, the movie would have been far different had George Lucas not taken the suggestion from Steven Spielberg to use John Williams. Because Steven Spielberg had been working on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and that episode of my podcast with Eric Woods, who is from Cinematic Sound Radio, will be up on December 30th of
Well,
this
and
month.
also Spielberg had used John Williams for Jaws, which came out in 75, I think. And I mean, that Jaws theme is so distinctive. I mean, you hear that first, but and you know exactly what that theme is. And that is kind of the signature for a John Williams composition, is that, kind of like the old Name That Tune game show. It only takes about four or five notes, and you can tell what piece it is, whether it's Star Wars or the theme for Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Superman the movie. I mean, all of those movies in that era with Williams' score on it are so distinctive and so memorable. And I think that definitely helped lead to the success of the movie.
And I found that originally George Lucas was going to use like existing classical music, like what Stanley Kubrick had used for 2001: A Space Odyssey. But that was before Steven Spielberg introduced him to John Williams. And so with them, Lucas and Williams, they collaborated on agreeing to have a kind of classical 19th century romantic music style for the score. And since the movie would be shown to, see worlds that had never been seen before, and the music would serve as that emotional anchor for the audience to relate even to the film. I found that the music of by John Williams for Star Wars: A New Hope is ranked as number one of the AFI's 100 Years of Film Scores. I thought that really cool.
Yeah,
And
it is so memorable. And last year, with the release of Episode 7, The Force Awakens, because this was the first film that Disney was putting out on the Star Wars franchise, and it was no longer tied or being distributed by 20th Century Fox. So this was the first movie that didn't open with the 20th Century Fox fanfare,
Yes.
and people were beside themselves
It was so
about it.
quiet.
And
It was just quiet. And they need what they really need to do is kind of give you kind of a introduction, or whoever is doing the next film, you want some kind of noise or some introduction to say, look, this is a Star Wars movie. It had just that 20th Century Fox had a great deal of influence on, how people perceived it, that they knew that if they heard that, they were going to get a John Williams score. Or they knew that that was how he was going to bring it about. When you were young, did you ever have any of the Star Wars record story?
I know I had some. I actually still have, and these are on cassettes, the radio adaptions Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. I remember my school library had a story record that I would check out at least every other month, it seemed like, there for a while, and I would bring that home to listen to. I had the comics, I had the toys, I had everything. I know in the early 1990s, during one of those times in college where I think, oh yeah, I'm going to join Columbia House and get 8 CDs for a penny. I had picked up, and I've got it here in my hand still. It's John Williams conducts John Williams, the Star Wars trilogy, and it's kind of viewed as the Skywalker Symphony. And basically, it's 13 tracks from episodes 4, 5, and 6. So you kind of get like the best of each movie. And I've just always carried that with me ever since. And I was actually re-listening to it today as I was driving around with my dad before coming in to the podcast recording today. I actually rewatched A New Hope yesterday, and I was amazed. I mean, yes, I know the music, and we've heard this music for almost 40 years now, but I was really amazed just how much music is in the movie, that there's times when it's playing under the dialogue and you don't even realize it until you're actually looking for it. I would probably say maybe 60% or 65% of the movie, there is music in the background, whether you realize it or not. I mean, I was just really shocked. I hadn't picked up on just how prominent it is unless you're really listening for it. Especially almost the first 30 minutes of the movie, there is almost constant music that whole time.
And a lot of the cues that were used, that John Williams used, he had them blend together. Like you get the scene of the rebel ship being attacked, and the whole scene of them coming onto the ship, and the droids going down to the planet, the droids separating and going in two separate directions. That whole choice of music flowed from one to another, and it was almost no separation of sound between each. And so you can see that John Williams really was telling a story through the music. I just always appreciated how with Star Wars you can listen to the score of any one of the movies and really see where these themes would begin. And even when John Williams went back to be doing the prequel trilogy, I mean, at some point down the line I will be reviewing some of these scores, but the whole idea that his music started very softly and there were elements of the Imperial March in the Phantom Menace, and you can't tell until you listen to the soundtrack or even stay to the final part of the credits and you hear that theme carefully woven through Anakin's theme. And I just found that astounding and really made me appreciate John Williams' music that much more.
Sure.
So these are, you know, some of the unique facts about you have real emotion in John Williams' music. And so I've got a few cues I'd like to play today. One of them, the very first I'd like to play, is called Imperial Attack. And you can see how John Williams brings to life the Imperial Army and its fight against the rebels and how they are, and how even in this film you don't get the Imperial March, but you get something that's a start, and you see how they are and what they are, and how the music plays a key role into their, so to speak, mythology. So I'd like to play now Imperial Attack.
Thank you.
All right, the next cue that I would like to play is called Tales of a Jedi Knight and Learn About the Force. Now, I also would like to play the piece that goes right after this cue. It's called Burning Homestead. Now, what kind of feelings, before I play this, what kind of feelings did you get when you watched the scene where Luke drives up in his land speeder to the home of Owen Lars and Beru and sees their burnt skeletons?
Yeah, the toast of young Cola Nan. The first time I watched this, I was seven, so I was just bug-eye. I was just trying to absorb everything in, and I don't think I probably fully realized that the aunt and uncle were dead until after he meets up again with Obi-Wan and the droids and put two and two together. But it felt kind of like a almost like a traditional fairy tale where Luke has finally been let go from the abusive or mean adoptive parents. It's his aunt and uncle. It's not his real parents. And so it really feels, almost along the lines of like Cinderella, where she gets free from the stepmother and can go off on her own now. And it's hard to say that characters are needed to die in order to advance the main character, but I think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, I would agree. And the idea that beforehand you get so much background into Obi-Wan Kenobi's character of, how he fought in the Clone Wars and that he knew Luke's father. And John Williams really gives us the mystery and the tragedy through these two cues. And it brings that emotion really to your heart to see, oh my goodness, he's just lost them. They were attacked by Imperial soldiers, and it really draws on your heart to know that this is an emotional piece. So what I'd like to do now is play Tales of a Jedi Knight, learn about the Force, and then I'll be having it weave right into Burning Homestead.
Thank you.
Alright, so the final cue that I'd like to play is another combination of two tracks. This is going to be the Battle of Yavin, as well as the Throne Room and End Titles. Now, when I think about these two pieces of music, I think of a grand finale. How do you feel about it, Jerry?
Grand finale is a good way to describe that. I've been to numerous weddings where people have used the throne room as their music to walk out of the church to, and it's a spectacular feeling, especially if you're part of the wedding party.
Mm-hmm.
but
it
really builds up, which is what the music should be doing. I mean, it builds you up towards that climatic finish, and you know, you got the big battle against the Empire and the Death Star, and the heroes come out of it just barely alive, but they defeat the enemy, and now we get the recognition, the reward at the end, where they're recognized as heroes for the first time in their life, and it's such a it ends on such a positive note. And you know, you compare and contrast it to the next film, Empire Strikes Back, which ends on such a down note. But when you realize that it's part of the trilogy and you're building the beats of the story, it works out perfect. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really amazing how the whole idea of these two tracks, even the tenseness and action of the Battle of Yavin and the tense build up of knowing how close the Death Star is coming to Yavin 4 and how close the rebels are to destroying the Death Star, and then you get Darth Vader coming in there and pounding down with that music, and John Williams uses those horns and that horn section so well in the scene, and it's just phenomenal.
Hindsight being 2020, why didn't the rebels just pack up and leave Yavin? I mean, the Empire is going to be coming. They're tracking them. I mean, in Empire Strikes Back, as soon as the Empires jump into the Hoth system, hey, it's time to go. Let's pack up. Let's get out of here. But with Yavin, oh no, we'll just stay here and try to take on the battle station that has already destroyed Alderaan. No big deal. Why? Why stay and fight? They should have been bugging out that whole time.
Yeah, but they
So, anyway.
didn't. But that's part of the enjoyment of the film. So, I've really enjoyed having you on today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this too.
It's been really nice to be able to talk with someone else about a beloved movie from my past, and I'm sure it's a beloved movie for you as well.
Very much so. I'm old school 1977. I saw it when it first came out. I was 6 or 7, and it's been part of my life ever since.
Yeah, and mine too. Really. Really from my birth. So, now I'd like to play those two cues, Battle of Yavin and Throne Room End Titles, and I'd like to encourage you all who are listening to come back and be with me next time, as I will be bringing the music of Alien with my special guest, Tim Benson. Once again, he'll be back on my show. And so, happy listening.
Thank you.